This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lori Garrett, just returned from 2 weeks in Zaire, covering the Ebola virus. She spent time in the capital, Kinshasa, in Kikwit, the center of the epidemic, and in outlying villages. She visited hospitals and talked with families of victims. Garrett is the author of the book, The Coming Plague, about newly emerging diseases. She's also medical and science writer for the New York newspaper Newsday. In today's edition of Newsday, she traces the root of this latest Ebola outbreak, beginning with the man who is now believed to be the first person infected. The symptoms of Ebola are fever, bloody diarrhea, and hemorrhaging from body orifices. There's no cure and no vaccine. The virus is spread by contact with infected body fluids. This outbreak appears to have been contained.
We saw a dramatic slowdown in the numbers of both new cases and deaths that occurred. In the beginning, the numbers of cases and deaths were quadrupling every 3 days. By the time I left, they'd seen 6 new cases in 8 days. So that's a really radical slowdown. And the people themselves are, you know, possessed of a strong amount of common sense. They took the precautions under serious advisement that were provided to them by the World Health Organization and the international team of scientists there. And you could see radical changes in behavior, and in particular, the kinds of behavior that would put people at risk for transmitting the virus.
How much of the containment of the virus do you think is the result of education and health measures, and how much is a result of something inherent in the virus, that the virus ran its course?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure we're going to know the answer right now. I think there's going to have to be a lot of scientific research there, going around testing for samples in people who never got sick to see, you know, has the virus actually changed genetically over the course of this epidemic. But there certainly is a reason to think at this point it's a combination of the two things you describe. Definitely people change their behavior, radical change, particularly on the issue of how they handled their dead. It is traditional in that part of the world for people to, the closest family members, particularly the spouse, the surviving spouse, to wash the body of the dead and then to prepare the body in a coffin in proper clothing and so on for burial. And then the funerals are open casket funerals, and it is part of the tradition of saying goodbye to the dead to kiss the cadaver, to touch the cadaver, and so on. And these are not unusual behaviors. This is true all over the world in many different cultures. But when you have a bodily fluid transmissible virus that has a lethality of 90%. These are procedures that are extraordinarily dangerous. And it seemed to me that the populace was really getting the message.
So, Lori, what were the most effective ways of getting the message to people about the virus and about how to take precautions against the spread of it?
Very tough, because we're talking about an area that is called a city by virtue of the fact that there's a huge number of people living there.
You're talking about Kinshasa?
No, Kikwit. The population of Kikwit is estimated to be somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 people. Nobody really knows for sure because there's no real government and nobody does census anymore in Zaire anywhere. But it is a huge, sprawling village. It has none of the attributes of a city except population density. It has only one paved road, not surprisingly, named Boulevard Mobutu after the president. It has no running water, no electricity, virtually no social services. So it's really crazy to call this place a city in the sense that it had none of the attributes, the positive attributes of a city. And one of the problems that posed for in terms of public education is, you know, nobody's going to be able to turn on the radio or the television to get news. There was no newspaper in Kikwit. There is no basic source of information except what people call bush radio, which is to say the word of mouth, rumor vine. What the international authorities did was to set up immediately both passive and active surveillance teams. the passive surveillance teams were located in the various medical clinics that people might go to if they were sick. And these people would screen, were trained to recognize the symptoms and screen Ebola cases. Once a case was found, to immediately talk to whatever family members came in with that case, get blood tests on these people, and teach them immediately how to protect themselves. The active surveillance teams were going out all over Kikwit and all the nearby villages looking for hidden cases of the disease. And as they went, they would pass out pamphlets that described, that were hastily prepared mimeographed sheets that described the basic ways you could protect yourself against the disease.
In your travels around Zaire, did you see much fear or panic?
Certainly, there was quite a bit of fear and panic and quite a bit of tremendous concern. But over time, I saw the fear kind of get balanced a bit as people began to realize, all right, it's frightening, but there are ways that I can take control of the situation. This isn't just a matter of fate and some evil will be visited upon me. This is something that I can have some control over.
What are some of the ways that the fear expressed itself?
Oh, there were so many things. I am only now beginning in my mind to sort out everything I saw and experienced in the time I was there, all the funerals, all the wakes, all the burial proceedings, all the panic and wailing and so on. The city really rang with the sound of wailing. The tradition there is that when someone dies, the oldest child or surviving spouse will immediately go into a wailing that begins with a shouting in Kigongo, someone has died, someone has died, and then an announcement who it is. My husband has died. He was a good husband. He was a good father. He leaves me with seven children, etc. The chant would then escalate, and the attributes of the dead would be described, and one by one, other members of the family would join in, neighbors would join in, and the biography of the individual who had just died would be described, but described in screaming, wailing, and a sort of frenetic dancing, and then, of course, sobbing and crying. And when I first arrived in Kikwit, one could literally just drive around and hear this all over from one neighborhood to another. Well, of course, if you live in the city and you hear from one neighborhood to another this wailing, it has a profound effect on you. It builds a sense of not only anxiety for your own health, but a sense of despair for the community as a whole, a sense that something horrible and terrifying has visited upon the society.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lori Garrett, author of the book The Coming Plague. She's also a medical and science writer with Newsday. Did you go to any of the hospitals in Zaire?
Certainly. And whatever you have read or heard or visually seen about these facilities cannot possibly capture the essence, how horrible these facilities really are. I have traveled rather extensively in Africa over the years. I've covered AIDS in Africa, in remote villages, and all over East Africa and Southern Africa, and I frankly had never seen a hospital as horrible as Kikwit General Hospital.
Would you describe what it looked like?
It is a single-story set of buildings connected by covered walkways, blue stucco, basically. The floors are concrete. The walls are concrete. There are beds. Most of the beds did not have mattresses. They just had the raw coil springs, which, of course, would not be a pleasant experience to lay upon. Those that did have mattresses had no linens of any kind. There was no running water. Patients that were begging for water could not be given water because there was none. Nobody on the entire medical staff had been paid, in some cases, since 1991.
Gee.
When the National Bank was looted thoroughly by Mobutu and his supporters in the government, and the army went on rebellion and looted Kinshasa and much of the country because they had gone unpaid. Since then, virtually all civil servants have had to resort to other means to survive. And for physicians and nurses, That other means has basically been to take whatever medical supplies did arrive at the hospital and sell them immediately on the black market. So if you were hospitalized at Kikwit General, you had to first, or your family had to on your behalf, find those things that were necessary for your care. If, for example, you had appendicitis, your family had to go out and find some anesthesia, find some antibiotics, find a clean scalpel somewhere, etc., and bring the supplies to the physicians before the surgery could be performed.
You know, the doctors and nurses in the hospital, you said they hadn't gotten paid since probably 1991. They sold the hospital goods on the black market. Did they know what they were doing medically?
Yes. And in fact, the horror of it is that some of these people, particularly the head of the hospital, were incredibly well-trained physicians. The head of the hospital had studied medicine in the United States, and they were very well aware of the dangers of the situation. They were not heartless human beings. On the contrary, they were doing everything they could with virtually no support from the outside world to deal with ongoing medical care and then the epidemic crisis that befell them. But, you know, these people worked at tremendous personal risk, and many of them lost their lives. They had no protective gear. They had no gloves. They had no masks. They had nothing to protect them from the virus. And similarly, the Red Cross, all of whom were unpaid volunteers, were the ones who would gather people who were ill and bring them to the hospital and then take the cadavers away for burial. When these people started their tasks, they had no protective clothing whatsoever, and four of them died of Ebola that they got from the bodies that they carried away.
I thought a lot of the doctors and nurses had fled after the outbreak was identified.
Some had, but frankly, the majority were still there and working long, selfless hours.
What precautions did you take before entering the hospital?
None.
None?
Well, you just use common sense. You don't touch things. It's not an airborne virus. There's no reason to be terrified. I understand that a lot of my colleagues, other medical writers and so on, refused assignments to go to the epidemic out of a sense of personal fear. I don't understand that. It's not an airborne virus. It's not an easy virus to catch. You have to actually directly be in contact with contaminated bodily fluids. And if you're smart and you don't touch people, they had a, in fact, there was a new handshake. People no longer were greeting each other in salutation by reaching out and shaking hands. The new Kikwit handshake that everybody quickly adopted was touching elbows. Which hopefully were clothed elbows, to avoid spreading the virus hand to hand. I mean, as long as you didn't share food, you didn't touch people, you didn't touch something that someone who might have been contaminated just touched, you were all right.
Did you speak to any of the sick people, or were they too sick to talk?
Way too sick to talk.
Yeah. Were there things you looked for when watching them? I mean, about the effects of the virus that you had described before but hadn't seen?
The one effect I had never seen before or had described to me before that is quite an amazing symptom is this hiccuping. It sounds humorous, but it was not. As part of the hemorrhagic effect of the virus, their diaphragms would go into uncontrolled paroxysms, and they would start hiccup, 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 and they would spend hours on end just gasping for air. Hiccup, hiccup. Horrible. Horrible thing.
Hmm. People must have been afraid to take sick members of the family to the hospital.
Yes, they were. And, I mean, let's face it, if you knew that medical staff in the hospital were dying of Ebola, and you knew that it looked like the epidemic started in the hospital, now, we now know that's not true, but it was certainly amplified into a full societal-level epidemic by the experiences in the hospital. Then it was not an irrational response to say, hey, we're not taking them to the hospital. A lot of people, as the epidemic wore on, would take their ailing relatives to the villages, which was how it then spread in many of the villages in the area.
Lori Garrett is my guest. She just got back from about 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola outbreak. She's also the author of the book The Coming Plague and is the medical and science writer for Newsday. Lori, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lori Garrett, author of The Coming Plague. She just got back from 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola outbreak. Well, in your assessment, was taking the sick to the hospital a good idea in terms of containing the virus? Or do you think it would just made for more misery in the hospital? It doesn't sound like there was a whole lot that the medical staff could do except keep the people quarantined and prevent other people from coming in contact with them.
Well, but those are really important things.
Right,
and
right.
In terms of controlling an epidemic, those were essential. Once the team got on the ground, and in particular Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, a Belgian-based organization, got on the ground, it really became essential to improve the hospital facility and make it the primary place that everybody did come. And they had a huge credibility gap to deal with, of course, in the public mind. But Médecins Sans Frontières was just remarkable. Three people, that's all, three doctors came in, and they took one look at that hospital and said, all right, our task in this epidemic is sanitation and hospital credibility. And they marched right in. They tried to hook up the ancient water system and figured out there was a reason there was no running water. All the pipes were clogged up in a mess. And so they set up a rainwater catch facility with a filtration device. And immediately, within the first day of their arrival, they had running water established for the hospital. They also immediately set up a cordon sanitaire, an actual physical set of barriers to isolate off the ward that called Pavilion Number 3, where the patients were kept that had Ebola. And they set up a triage system in the emergency room to identify any incoming people who might be suspect Ebola cases, bring them into the facility, and then to turn everybody else away. So all other medical care was shut down, and it just became an Ebola center so that they didn't run the risk of people getting contaminated in the hospital who weren't already exposed.
You've actually helped trace the Ebola outbreak to the first person who contracted the virus during this outbreak. Who was it? When did they get it?
Yeah, before I tell you the answer, I first want to make a little aside. Two points I think are real important. One is any names I use, any people I identify, it has been explicitly with their permission. A lot of the press has been using people's names without ever asking them, and a great deal of shame and anger built among a lot of the residents of Kikwit when their photographs were taken without their permission, when film was made of them without their permission, and when their names were used without their permission. So whatever names I use, I had the permission to use these names. The second thing is, anything I say about how this all got started is, of course, based on current state of knowledge. The original epidemic control team pulled out this weekend from Kikwit because it is under control. And now a whole new team of scientists has been brought in. These are people who will be here for a long haul, 3, 4, 5 months, doing field investigation of every single aspect of this epidemic. And it may be that they will discover things that contradict what I'm about to say. But here is the current state of understanding. A farmer by the name of Gaspar Menga lived in Kikwit and had a small plot of maize and a small plot of manioc that he was cultivating about 18 miles outside the city in a rainforest area near the Mwembe River. Every day he would get to this site either by walking or hitching a ride if anybody with a vehicle happened to come by. And there he would cultivate his crops and go into the rainforest, chop down trees, and burn them to make charcoal, which he would sell in the city as fuel. Somehow, we assume towards the end of December, Gaspar got exposed to whatever animal it is that normally carries this virus. And when I went and studied this area and talked extensively to members of the animal search team, Dr. Robert Swanepoel from the National Virology Institute in Johannesburg, Dr. Oyeba Timori from the WHO offices in Harare, Zimbabwe, there are several things that are very striking about this site. And it's exciting that this is the first time in any Ebola outbreak we really seem to have a pinpointed possible source site, an ecology, if you will, to study. This is rainforest area. It's right on the edge of the whole periphery around it has been deforested for cultivation. And it is a rainforest that is oddly silent. Most rainforests I've been in, you hear the birds, the monkeys screeching. There's a sense of animal life. This is a rainforest lush in botanical life, but seem almost lifeless in terms of animals. The ants, the mosquitoes, the rats, the bats, and the mice seem to be about it. And all larger mammals have long since been hunted into extinction from the area. That has prompted a large investigation now, a real effort to focus on the rodents.
So the person who first got Ebola in this outbreak worked near this rainforest.
Worked in it.
And he probably came into contact with the animal that carries the virus.
Right.
What else did you find out about how he picked it up? Does anybody know anything about that yet, or is that the big mystery?
Well, there's a very active effort going on in that ecology to find, you know, the missing animals, to find whatever species it is that normally carries this virus. Gaspar came home and on January 6th came down with all the classic symptoms of Ebola, though, of course, nobody knew that's what it was at the time. He was diagnosed as a case of Shigella diarrhea, a bacterial disease that produces bloody diarrhea, one of the symptoms of Ebola. He died on January 13th, and I was shown photographs by the family members of his funeral, which we have published in today's Newsday with their permission. In that picture, it's really pretty hard to look at because Gaspar is in an open coffin and his family members surround the coffin, grieving it, many of them, as is traditional, cradling his head in their hands or touching his body. And all of those whose hands are in that coffin subsequently died of Ebola.
Lori Garrett is the author of The Coming Plague, and she's the medical and science writer for Newsday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Lori Garrett will be back with us in the second part of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Lori Garrett. She just got back from 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola epidemic. Garrett wrote about the earlier outbreaks of Ebola in her recent book, The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. She writes about science and medicine for the New York newspaper Newsday. In the first part of our show, Garrett talked about how the current epidemic was contained. She traced the spread of the virus from the farmer Gaspar Menga, who is now believed to be the first man killed in this epidemic. Garrett says that tracing the progression of the outbreak gave her some basis for optimism.
It really does look like this virus is so rarely in human beings that it is, from a biological point of view, poorly adapted to humans, which is to say it kills them too fast. It's not in the interest of a virus to instantly kill off its hosts, because then where are you going to go live? If you're a virus, you want a happy home, and you want, ideally, to be like the AIDS virus, where you will eventually kill your host, but you'll have a happy home to live in and reproduce in for 10 or 12 years, and many opportunities to be spread to other human beings over those 10 or 12 years. Killing your host in 4 or 5 days and making them so sick that they don't get up, walk around, and cough on other people is just not very smart from the point of view of a virus. And it looks like, normally, in whatever host it resides in, it's relatively harmless. It hit the human race and bam, it's a killer. But what we could see is that with subsequent passages through humans, for example, within the Menga family, when it was obviously a real killer to Gaspar, and for most of the family members who were at his funeral, it was a real killer. Then they go to the villages, it seems to infect about half the people who directly contacted the sick in the villages in the first round. But by the second round and third round in the villages, which is to say the third or fourth generation of passage through the Menga clan chain of transmission, you had people who actively washed the bodies, who actively took care of the sleeping, dying people. You had children who shared beds with kids that were dying of Ebola, and none of them got the disease.
Now, do you think that this says something about the resistance that people breed internally, or does it say that the virus gets weaker over time?
It has to be the virus. There wasn't enough time for there to be the creation of a large-scale immunity in the population. It was much too rapid. This had to be that the virus itself was adapting to its human host, trying to become less virulent, less deadly.
This could help explain why this outbreak and previous outbreaks were relatively brief.
Yeah, the virus seems to burn itself out.
Now, if the virus can change that quickly, does that mean that it could also change in the opposite direction, hypothetically, and become transmittable through the air, through coughing and sneezing, or become more hardy and therefore have a longer period of the epidemic instead of these short-lived periods that we've seen so far?
Well, of course, that was the premise of the movie Outbreak. They had a fictional virus that was based on Ebola, and they had it, after, I think, one or two rounds of transmission through humanity, become an airborne, you know, super transmissible virus. I think that anything in nature might be possible, but you have to first come up with two key things to come up with an answer to your question. The first is, how many genes, how many actual genetic changes would it require for a virus that is confined to fluid-to-fluid transmission to become airborne transmissible? That turns out to be a very complex set, multiple set of genetic changes, not one simple little thing. And therefore, it's pretty hard to imagine that happening quickly. The second thing is, why would it be in the interest of the virus to do that? You have to, I don't want to anthropomorphize. It's not like the virus is sitting around thinking. But there has to be a biological advantage to becoming airborne, because making genetic changes requires expenditures of energy. It requires some concerted effort of some kind. It's not an utterly chance occurrence.
Gee, I think the advantage would be pretty obvious. The virus gets to spread to more people.
Yeah, but if in the contrary, the virus can, with a single gene change, become less virulent and therefore have happy homes for longer periods of time, that's probably an easier way to go.
Is there a fear that maybe what's happening is that the incubation period is lengthening and that some of the people who haven't gotten sick will get sick in 2 years?
I didn't hear that concerned voice by any of the scientists. I think that they see that as fairly unlikely, given just how much of a killer this virus is. It would be a very complex set of genetic changes for a virus to be able to go into a long-term latent state analogous to, say, HIV.
My guest is Lori Garrett, author of the book The Coming Plague. She just returned from 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola epidemic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Lori Garrett is my guest. Lori, when you were in Zaire, were there restrictions on journalists?
There certainly were. In the beginning, there were a lot of restrictions because the government took advantage of the quarantine situation to try and keep journalists from going into Kikwit. To NPR's credit, Michael Scholar got in there quite early and defied the quarantine order. I personally had a lot of difficulty getting from Kinshasa to Kikwit. But when I did go, I was the only journalist there who had long-term legal permission from the government to be there. Ironically, eventually, all these barriers broke down, and journalists were flying in from all over the world in these hordes that would show up, just horrendous. 20, 30, 40 journalists at once come clamoring into town and then want to have in 4 hours every single visual they can get their hands on, you know, the graveyard, the dying patient, the hospital, the anxious physicians, the anxious research team, then dash back to Kikwit Airport, fly back to Kinshasa, and file it by satellite to your respective news organization. I think one of the big take-home lessons of this epidemic, and I have discussed this extensively with people from both the CDC and WHO, is that we can no longer assume when epidemics occur that the only journalists that are going to come flying in to deal with it are going to be folks like me, medical reporters. It's now very clear the majority of this press corps were the same kind of folks who covered the Persian Gulf War or covered the Rwanda Civil War or what have you. They're crisis journalists. They fly in with their satellite dishes and their whole teams, and they need the visuals, and they need them now. And if they're in the way of your efforts to control the epidemic, well, too bad. They've got another job to do. And the levels of tension and animosity between the scientific team and the journalists were intense, horrendous. There, I actually know of at least two fistfights that broke out between journalists and international physicians who came in. And by the time I left, I think everybody had agreed that the fundamental biggest mistake they made was not having a professional press officer on the ground from the very first day to serve as the buffer between the very, very hungry press corps and the very urgently concerned scientific team.
Anything else that the CDC or, would you say the CDC and the World Health Organization,
mm-hmm.
anything else they decided to do next time around?
Well, I think that everybody saw that the necessary essential supplies and equipment were very slow to arrive. In fact, the bulk of the protective equipment that had been requested from day one of the epidemic for the medical staff, for the Red Cross, and so on, did not arrive until May 27th, when the Swedish government sent in a Hercules jet loaded with the essential equipment. And that's really terrible.
I guess one of the big mysteries remaining now about this outbreak of Ebola is, what is the animal that carries the virus and transmits it to humans? What kind of research is going on now to investigate that question?
That's the most exciting thing about this epidemic, is that we do have a what looks like a good source, starting point ecology. And with a limited number of animal species running around, we don't have to now say, well, it could be absolutely any animal in all of the African continent. We can narrow it down. And the scientific team that's working on that was actually quite charged up and excited. They set up a primitive field laboratory inside the old tuberculosis lab at Kikwit General Hospital, put it, with armed guards around it so that people wouldn't go in and contaminate themselves. And in that facility, they worked in whole-body respirator suits that were sweltering and stifling in the heat. But one of the scientists said it was a little bit like being wrapped up in saran wrap all day in the tropics. But obviously, they were having more direct contact with the virus than any of the other scientists, so they needed this protection. And they would go out by night and set traps, and in the morning go out and see what animals they had caught, then bring them back, mash them up, to mash up their livers, mash up their kidneys, study their blood, and try to see if they found Ebola virus. I also went out with some of the scientists who were actively looking for primates that were being kept as pets in Kikwit. It turns out there's quite a business in going to another remote rainforest area, not the area where Gaspar Menga worked, but a different area, about 300 kilometers away, and killing mother chimps or mother gorillas and then taking the babies and bringing them back into Kikwit or into Kinshasa for sale. And so I spent quite a bit of time hunting around Kikwit for these pets. And when I found any, I would tell the scientific team about it. And they, of course, were looking for them as well. And then they would take blood samples to see, were any of these macaques or baby gorillas or baby chimps carrying the Ebola virus? Most of the data on that is not in yet, but it was striking that we didn't find any cases that where there were pet primates and there were also human cases of Ebola. So I think it's pretty safe to say the monkeys were probably not the reservoir of the virus.
And when scientists do find the animal that is carrying Ebola, what options will they have?
Well, let's look at history. In my book, The Coming Plague, I describe other hemorrhagic fever diseases, viruses, where we have, in fact, traced it back to a rodent source. And I mean, it's very interesting that virtually all the hemorrhagic fever viruses do end up tracing to a rodent of some kind. The classic example would be the Machupo outbreak in Bolivia in the 1960s. It eventually turned out that there had been some changes in the local ecology, and as a result of those changes, this town had been overrun by what had been wild mice that suddenly realized that life was a lot easier for the mice. They could get the corn already chopped and piled up for them, just waiting for them. The mouse population flooded into this village, and that mouse population carried this virus that was harmless to most of the mice, but quite deadly to human beings. Once they were able to pinpoint this mouse is the carrier, then it was very easy to control and to prevent future epidemic outbreaks by simply having reasonable rodent control. Amongst the things they did in that particular case was to fly in a lot of pet cats.
You couldn't very well do that in a rainforest, though, could you?
Well, you might not be able to cleanse the rainforest, but you can certainly have the populace understand. Look, you know, put up pictures. This is the carrier of the virus. When you go out into your fields or hunting or whatever, avoid contact with this animal. And if you hunt, don't kill this animal and you know, skin it and so on, because exposure to its blood could be deadly.
Lori, the last time we spoke on Fresh Air, your book, The Coming Plague, had just been published, and you had just gotten back from covering the outbreak of plague in India. Now you've just come back from covering an outbreak of Ebola in Zaire. It's just remarkable. You know, you write this book, and all these illnesses are flourishing for you to study. So is it making you awestruck, terrified? What emotion is this leaving you with?
Well, you know, when I wrote The Coming Plague, I really secretly hoped that some of my case, of what I was stating, would turn out to be a little extreme. That we weren't really facing as grim a scenario as I was painting. I never could have imagined, when I was writing it a year ago at this time, doing the final edit on that book, that pneumonic plague would break out shortly afterwards, that Ebola would return after a 19-year hiatus to Zaire, and that in various parts of the world, antibiotic-resistant old bacterial diseases, but now mutant and different, would emerge and become major killers in totally industrialized, wealthy countries, and that Russia's healthcare would so degenerate that that former superpower, our age-old Cold War enemy, would now be facing huge epidemics of diphtheria, of cholera, of tuberculosis, of measles, of just go down the list. I really thought that I was writing something that was more in the future, more about a scenario for 10 or 15 years from now. And I am thoroughly stunned by the rapidity and the frequency and the severity of what's going on.
Any good thing you want to say before we wrap up?
Well, the good news is that I am experiencing from all over the world a sense of public awareness and heightened concern. I'm getting phone calls and letters from every country you can imagine, from people saying, you're right, we got to get moving on this thing. These emerging infectious disease problems are a global crisis, and we need to approach them as a global community. And my big hope is that this will result in some kinds of effective action, effective strategy, and hopefully even effective spending by the wealthy countries to deal with these crises.
Lori Garrett, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lori Garrett is the author of The Coming Plague, and she's medical and science writer for Newsday. This is Fresh Air.